second. All right, good morning, everybody, and welcome, welcome, welcome to the House of the Risen Sun, Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we are here through the lovely Skype, which I adore, although it's changing all the time. And so we can both talk to each other at the same time. People do wonder, you know, how can you do that? Two people talk at the same time or on the same microphone on Pow Talk, and that's how we do it, is through Skype. So yeah, we were talking about just before we came on about how you might have listened to a teacher, which I was listening to Adi Ashanti, who is one of my, you know, favorite kind of teachers in non-course, and how he used to not be so much in alignment with the Course in Miracles. I mean, he was, but there were some things that were not. But you know, now he seems perfectly aligned, and I'm wondering if it's because I've changed and I see the sameness, or that he's changed. And I guess you really can't tell, really. It's all the same thing, isn't it? And yeah, it's both, Carrie is saying. And yeah, well, I'm listening to an old recording, so it's a recording I listened to before and had some differences about, and it doesn't seem to be too different to me now. So I think we both change. And I think that's part of this, actually, the holographic world thing. I think that it's that dimensional shifts that we go through when our mind changes actually does change, you know, it changes the I guess the dream. It doesn't change the dream, it just moves us into a different dream. It's kind of a different illusion than it was before, and it's an illusion where things are more in agreement with each other.
A forgiving dream, shall we say?
Yeah, a forgiving dream, exactly, exactly. See, that's a great thing, just great.
Not original.
is anything? What's original in this? You know, that's the thing, too. If we're all the author of the dream, then plagiary is kind of a moot point.
Right. We're all plagiarizing perfect oneness and passing it off as our own fabrication, right? Of course, anything that's a copy is woefully inadequate to the original. And I think that holds true, particularly in the case of metaphysics.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And even looking in the mirror, I mean, you can look in the mirror or even at a hologram and have like a perfect 3D copy, apparently, of what it is, but it isn't the same thing. You can't make a copy that's perfect, that is exact. That's why this world is the mess it is because we try to copy heaven with, instead of having, you know, state-of-the-art equipment and materials, we try to copy heaven using sticks and stones and mud and
and breaking bones.
Breaking bones. Our copy of heaven is, what is the, Jesus called it, a shabby substitute.
And yeah, exactly. In fact, interesting you mentioned that, because I was reading in one of Ken's writings in The Journey Home this morning, and he picked out yet another phrase from the Course that describes the body, and I was writing next to that, the rotting prison, the need machine, and, you know, the, offense, you know, against love, basically. I'm paraphrasing that one, but, you know, the first few are actually all in the Course is descriptions of the, you know, the substitute that the body is. And, you know, the idea being, you know, why would you want to invest your identity in that? And he's not saying that we're not going to do it. He's just saying, you know, just watch yourself when you start doing that. And, you know, that can be our forgiveness classroom. We can forgive ourselves for thinking that we were going to somehow find some kind of peace, identified as a body, and that somehow there was something in the world, of form of space and time that was going to, you know, make us peaceful, you know, from the outside in. It was going to be something that was going to force us to be peaceful if we had just all the right ducks in a row and everything, all the stars aligned. And whatever metaphor you like, and if everything was exactly the way our egos wanted it, which is never going to happen, of course, we'd still never be happy because the whole premise is wrong. I mean, the whole premise is that we couldn't be happy. Yeah.
Because the ego can't be satisfied.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no way possible within a dream of duality for the peace that comes only from oneness to enter. And that's why, you know, the analogies of hermetically sealed, you know, is that, you know, that it can't enter. There's no way oneness can enter a world of duality and vice versa. They're mutually exclusive. But the beauty of it is, that what we really are, it really is the oneness. But the duality that we believe ourselves to be, is terrified of that. And we'll go to enormous lengths, even to the point of building an entire universe from scratch. Every, you know, 10 to the minus 44 seconds we do this, according to modern physics, give or take. You know, the Planck time constant. We have this little stroboscopic, hallucinatory, holographic 3D cosmos that we made up to convince ourselves that we still have some kind of mechanism for escaping from, you know, the unconscious but unfounded guilt of our split, deluded minds. What a wacky thing that is, isn't it? I mean, if you really think about all that.
It is. It's a wonderful world.
Well, and you know, it's interesting, because I listen to, you know, so many, you know, song lyrics and watch movies and you know participate in, you know, just being a consumer of the news like everyone else. But I find that it's really helpful to just notice that in every single bit of it, whether it's a little snippet from a song lyric or a plot twist in a movie or something that's uttered from a politician, I can see that it's either an expression of love or a call for love. It's always one of those two things. And it's not somebody else's expression of love or call for love. It's my expression of love or my call for love seen properly. And the my, being the decision maker, my, you know, it's basically, if I can see it properly, then I am healing the world in each moment by forgiving the idea of separation in my mind. And then, it's a very gentle, compassionate view of the world. And it sees everyone as, including the self that I think I am, the little self, as a dreamer that's just having a bad dream. And our inner parent, if you will, our inner kindness teacher, that our older brother, I like the metaphor that the Course uses, you know, it just is gently whispering, this is just a silly dream you've made up, you know. You can wake from it. You can wake up from it. I can say that anytime you like.
Anytime you like. Anytime. I like to. I just wanted to say something that came to me when you were saying these things, because what I recognize is that yes, you know, I spend quite a bit of my day actually condemning everybody I see around me for one thing or another, and it could be just something so simple as, you know, you spilled coffee on the table and you didn't wipe it up, or you're, you know, supposed to be leading the country and you're, you know, doing crazy crap. You know, I look at these things and I make all these ideas up and these things that make me dissatisfied about this dream. This particular dream that I'm in, or I appear to be in, that is appearing to be what happens in this particular dream that I'm in. And as long as I'm in this dream, or I believe that I'm in this dream, that is what I'm going to see. But what the Course is telling us, and I believe Artin and Persa are telling us, because, you know, they talk about stuff like, you know, conspiracy theories and war and all this kind of stuff, and I'm thinking, I don't think that's, you know, I don't see that as, you know, being really happening or really could be happening. But I realize that in that's a particular version of the dream that is absolutely as real as this particular version of the dream that I'm dreaming. What I recognize is that when we do what the work that Jesus is asking us to do, and, you know, today's lesson is just a huge example of, you know, what he's asking us to do is to, you know, stop trying to do things under my will and to align myself with God's will, which means I need to stop judging my brother and start seeing him as the whole, the same, the Christ. Mm-hmm. And as I stop judging my brother and begin to see him as whole and healed and the Christ, then the dream that I am dreaming becomes a different kind of dream. Mm-hmm. And those things that are making me so distressed in this dream are no longer a factor. They're no longer in existence. And that's, you know, when Jesus talks about the real world, that, you know, that still is a part, is a dream, and it's still a part of the illusion, but it's a better dream. It's a dream where there's no conflict. And so as long as I'm in a dream that's filled with conflict, I will be in a state of distress and unhappiness. Mm-hmm. When I move into a dream where there's no conflict, there will be nothing to be distressed or unhappy about. That doesn't happen because I'm a good girl and God decides to do that for me. That doesn't happen because somehow or the other I earn up enough points, like in The Good Place, that, you know, I get to, you know, go see that. That happens to me because I let go of my judgment, my determination to see this world as a sinful place, my determination to be guilty. When I give that up, then it's automatic. It's not a reward. It's a consequence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just like if I step on a nail, I get, you know, a bloody foot. That it's the same kind of thing. If something happens that changes, that shifts and changes the situation, the situation becomes different. And the different situation is the different, is a situation of peace and joy and no conflict. So, you know, that's really what I'm going for. I'm not going, you know, as much as I want to change the world, you know, I want to make my will God's will. You know, I, you know, God, if you just would do it this way, then everything would be cool. But no, that's not happening. So, yeah, so let's go ahead and read.
Okay.
And I have us on 189.
Did we get that far?
Maybe we did it. Maybe
I think we got to the top of 188, and I was going to back us up to the last paragraph on 187.
Okay. All right. Let's do that.
Okay.
You just start, and then I'll see where we're at, because my pages are different, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, as Lynn and I have been saying for, I guess, about a year now, maybe, you know, just give or take a week or two, right? We've been reading from The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions, Gary R. Renard's fourth book. And so anyway, it, in the part where we were reading last week, they were talking about how, you know, we really could become enlightened at any time. But, you know, we're usually freaked out about that, and so we have to, at our own pace, let go of the insanity of the egoic thinking of the belief in separation, basically. And so the last concluding statement from Artin says, in doing so, which is forgiveness, you can be enlightened in this lifetime. And Gary says, that would be fine with me. You know, most of the time I've been getting better and better at practicing forgiveness. It's like when I was playing guitar, when I was a guitar player, I'd keep finding better ways to play just by doing it. It's the same with forgiveness. The more you do it, the better you get at it. The one thing that bothers me is that even though I've been doing it for a long time, once in a while, forgiveness is really hard. Some things still push my buttons. And I heard Ken say that even he got annoyed once in a while. Does that ever end? Presumably referring to Ken Wapnick. Arden, the time comes when, yes, it does end. It did for Ken. It takes much dedication and practice, and you'll have the frustration you just mentioned. You'll wonder if you'll ever get to the point when nothing bothers you. When that happens, remember you can't always see the results of your forgiveness and the healing results, and you can't judge what you can't see. The Course says it's not the function of God's teachers to evaluate the outcome of their gifts. It is merely their function to give them. Have faith, and the time will come when peace is totally restored to your mind, no matter what appears to happen. In the meantime, you're getting much better. Aren't you at peace most of the time? Gary, that's true. I remember what I was like just before you appeared to me for the first time. I was anything but peaceful. I worried about everything. I mean, I worried so much I didn't even know I was worrying. I just thought it was normal. Except for my brother, Paul, there was hardly anyone I had a nice, peaceful relationship with. I couldn't make anything work. Even though I'd been on a spiritual path for about 15 years at the time, my life still sucked. Yeah, it was a lot better than it was before I got on a spiritual path, which tells you how much my life must have sucked back then. But like I've told you before, there was something missing. I got so much into the presidential election of 92, I almost made myself sick. I wasn't happy at all, and I had no idea what to do about it. Then, I remember very clearly, I made a decision. I said to myself, I want to remove conflict from my life. Fits pretty nicely with today's workbook lesson, doesn't it? I had no idea what a tall order that was, because I didn't know how much conflict I had in my mind. And I'm not blaming anybody else for the way I felt. It was me. Even then, because of EST, that's Earhart Seminars Training, that he participated in, and probably lots of other people you know did too, and maybe you did, I'd already learned I wasn't a victim. I knew there wasn't any power in that. And I made that decision. I think it was that decision that led to you guys showing up to me. I had to be ready to hear what you had to say. Applying what you've taught me, I've changed so much with the course that I guess I usually forget about the way I used to be. Like most people, I think I was always this way, but I wasn't. When I think about it, I can see that I've changed enormously. I don't worry about things the way I used to. I don't care as much about what people think. I remember it used to be so important how it looked. Now, who cares? We're all going to be dead in a few years anyway. Let's forgive, move on, and have a good time. Today, I can't think of anyone I don't have a forgiven relationship with. And speaking on the road is easy. The first time I got up and talked about the course in front of people, I was terrified. After 5 or 6 times and a lot of forgiveness, it was no big deal. It was fun. Today, it's no more stressful than brushing my teeth. Travel is still a forgiveness opportunity, though. When I started, it was cool. Back then, the airlines treated me like I was a customer. Now they treat me like I'm a suspect. So does the TSA, even though I have a KTN, a known traveler number, which gets me on the pre-checklist. That's supposed to get me through security faster, but they still treat me like there's something wrong with me. I wonder if it's because of what I've written. Anyway, at least now I know what it's all for. So if I take the time to think about it, yes, everything is different than when you first came to me. And I can tell the process is accelerating. I've been hurt in a couple of minor accidents, and it should have made me feel pain, but it didn't. And I thought, that's strange, that should hurt. My body is more elastic, and it feels lighter, even though I weigh more than I used to. It's a figure in a dream. You know what? I'm going to start feeling more grateful. Thank you. You've given me even more to think about and work with. Persa. And thank you, brother. It's been a long visit, but rewarding. We're going to leave you with some words from Jay. We'll be back for one more discussion, this last one of the series. Until then, be well. Our love is with you. And then they have a quote. Do you want to read that quote?
Sure. Yeah, I'll do that. And a lot of things came up while you were reading that, though. And I was thinking about how things have shifted and changed with me and, you know, my physical body. I've actually, because I'm getting older, have a lot of things breaking down, but it doesn't really matter because it has nothing to do with me. I used to be so caught up in my physical body and, you know, wanting to look like this or be like that. I don't even get dressed most days now.
Hey, I'm sitting here in my sweats, you know, but I do usually put on, you know, street clothes when I leave the house, but when I go exercise, I don't.
God's work in the yard or something like that, but for the most part, you know, I don't care about anything anymore. So, you know, that's a good thing. Excuse me. So let me read what they believe.
Before you do, can I share something that I really enjoyed from Krishnamurti? There was a quote that I came across several years ago that I really liked of his, that is, you know, you know, somebody asked him, what's your secret? And his response was, well, I'll tell you, my secret is this, you know, I'm paraphrasing greatly here, of course. He says, I don't care about what happens. I think that's what he said. And the idea wasn't that he was uncaring in the sense that, you know, he was, had no compassion or no feelings of empathy or whatever. But the idea is that he went beyond the facade of what's happening in space and time and recognized that caring about what happens in the sense of being upset or, you know, adversely impacted by what does or doesn't happen in the realm of space-time is exactly what A Course in Miracles is encouraging us to look at, how we've all done that. And I couldn't help but resonate with what you said, you know, when you just kind of notice throughout the day how many times, you know, you're tempted to get upset with something and just catch yourself doing that. And I think it's that mindfulness that sees how insane the ego is. And when we first start looking at this, I think we spend very little time noticing how crazy our minds are. And the more we look at the contents of our minds and not condemn the ego's blather, and when it comes up and is it, and it's kind of like a 24/7, you know, ticker tape or a crawler track on the bottom of our mind screen that has all this misinformation, misinterpretation, and just out and out lies. I mean, it's not any different than, shall we say, turning on the news from a certain, you know,
yeah,
political or otherwise, you know, kind of thing. Because it's all propaganda for the belief in separation. And if we can just kind of learn to gently say, yeah, I'll do what I need to do in the world, but I'm not going to take it seriously. And you just, I think said it very eloquently is sure, you know, do the appropriate thing so that you don't, blatantly offend or whatever, people in your life, you know, be normal, you know, but at the same time, not make a big deal about it. And so why not be relaxed and casual and more importantly, at peace? It's not about the form. It's always about what's going on in the mind, and be at peace with whatever seems to be happening or not happening. Which ties into Krishnamurti's quote very nicely. It's just basically, you know, don't let the form deceive, and just recognize that the peace, and then sharing that peace with everyone, because that's in our mind, is what's really important, and that's where the true compassion is. So,
absolutely, and that's it. It's all in the mind.
Yeah.
And so. I think it's not a Krishnamurti quote, but there's some kind of quote that says, if you don't mind what happens or something, nothing matters. I don't know.
Yeah. Probably a lot of people have said similar things over the millennia. Huh?
Okay. So let me go ahead and read this quote from the Course, uh-huh. And I'll continue reading to the end of the chapter, and then we get a new chapter coming up. Yay.
Yeah.
Okay. So the quote from the Course is, your relationship with your brother has been uprooted from the world of shadows, and its unholy purpose has been safely brought through the barriers of guilt, washed with forgiveness, and set shining and firmly rooted in the world of light. From there, it calls to you to follow the course it took, lifted high above the darkness, and gently placed before the gates of heaven. The holy instant in which you and your brother were reunited is but the messenger of love sent from beyond forgiveness to remind you of all that lies beyond it. Yet it is through forgiveness that it will be remembered. And when the memory of God has come to you in the holy place of forgiveness, you will remember nothing else, and memory will be as useless as learning, for your only purpose will be creating. Yet this you cannot know until every perception has been cleansed and purified and finally removed forever. Forgiveness removes only the untrue, lifting the shadows from the world and carrying it safe and sure within its gentleness to the bright world of new and clean perception. There is your purpose now, and it is there that peace awaits you. So that's the place. That's what we were just talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that we come to the place where there's no more judgment, no more differentiation between things, no more perception. That comes from forgiveness and joining with my brother in this forgiveness, this place where nothing has gone wrong. And in that place, you're in this real world. Where you're in a bright new world of clean new perception,
exactly.
Gentle. I mean, there's nothing to worry about or be afraid of.
And nothing to get hung about. As you were sharing that wonderful quote, Lynn, which I'm now tempted to look and find out where in the course it is. I was thinking of a metaphor of training wheels for a bicycle, and I don't probably a lot of people if they learn to ride with training wheels on a bike will appreciate the metaphor is, you know, you strap these little wheels on the back, usually on the back of the rear wheel, and they keep you from falling over. And, you know, and I think that's what forgiveness is, you know, the forgiveness classroom that A Course in Miracles has is sort of like training wheels. It's like training the mind to, you know, keep it steady, keep it, you know, from going to one side or another. It's not about sides. It's about the center, which where everything really truly is beyond balance. It's one, you know, it just is still and quietly does nothing. But, you know, the training wheel is kind of like the metaphor is kind of like the idea that, you know, we really don't have anything to worry about once we start forgiving, because once we start forgiving, we know that we're getting more and more proficient at seeing things as they really are, not tilted or distorted in any way, but we're seeing the innocence that really is there. And at some point, you know, we don't need the forgiveness anymore, because that's all that's left is that that proficiency, that mindful alignment with the Holy Spirit's 24/7, 365 message, which is, you know, no one has sinned. There is perfect innocence in truth, in eternity, not in the realm of the dream, because, you know, the dream is basically just that. It's a hallucination. But in truth, there is no evil, darkness, and sin. And it's only because we made those things up as a maladaptive mechanism to escape from a problem that never happened. And it's an unfounded sin, guilt, fear paradigm that we seem to need those training wheels. But once we've practiced those forgiveness lessons sufficiently and where it becomes second nature and automatic, you know, we don't need the training wheels. We don't need the thing to prop up our mind and remember that everything is just an expression of love or a call for love, right?
Oh yeah, exactly. And you remind me of, I mean, I love that training wheels idea. I do have a three wheel bicycle that my son bought me because I have a balance problem. But
there you go.
You remind me of when I was, you know, studying Buddhism, and I didn't do est. I was a Buddhist, so I didn't
a Buddhist.
Yeah, Buddhist. Yeah, I didn't do est. I was Buddhist. But the Tai Chi Tu. The symbol that we call the yin yang symbol.
Okay.
That's how I was trained, is that you ride the line, the middle, and so you go on neither side. You just balance in the middle and ride the line. And I always imagine myself riding a bicycle.
Oh, cool.
Along the middle line between the yin and the yang. So that makes perfect sense. It is just a matter of riding the line and not going one way or the other, not being swayed one way or the other, not being, and you know when you're doing it, because, you know, you're feeling something, some kind of an emotion, you know, and even Jesus says, you know, you're doing this right when you don't feel anything. You have no sway one way or the other. You know, you don't get angry or upset or afraid or worried or, but on the other hand, then the what we call in the world, joy and happiness, you know, because that joy and happiness is conditional you know, it depends on, you know, certain things happening. You know, you don't have, the world doesn't provide you with spontaneous joy or true joy and happiness, although you can and do feel those things. And, you know, I think about looking at, or, you know, holding my little grandbaby, you know, looking in her little eyes. You know, there's a spontaneous joy that comes from that that I think is unconditional. I think it just comes from just the joy of being with another pure being. But I don't feel that same joy when I'm, you know, talking to, you know, the police officer that just pulled me over, or I'm trying to think of, you know.
Why not?
You might be, you know, unhappy. My husband was just watching things about police officers pulling people over. But that's probably why that came to my mind. But if it was in this place that Jesus is talking about, then looking at your face right here on the little round thing on the Skype should bring me just the same joy that I get from looking at my little granddaughter or looking at a baby, because you're no different.
There's no difference between any of us. That's really one of the precursor ideas that, as Ken Wapnick points out, is so difficult, because we were happy to include, you know, even, you know, in fairly advanced stages, we think, you know, we said, well, I include, you know, most of the 7 billion people in the world, but if you just leave one person out, or really in truth, if you leave one amoeba or one insect, you know, or one species of plant, you know, a carnivorous plant, say, you know, if you leave one thing out, you know, one molecule of carbon or silicon in some remote part of the cosmos, you know, if that isn't perfectly innocent, then we're saying, well, then I'm not innocent either, because it's an all or nothing proposition. And it always seems like it's an extreme and harsh thing, but it's really the opposite of that. The only thing that's really harsh is the judgment that we made as individuals upon, reality, and by making it into duality. And that's, you know, a severe sentence that we can undo just by changing our mind's jurisdiction.
So we undo by not doing, and
I really like how Ken Wapnick points out over and over again, it's not that we don't have the thoughts, we just kind of watch them and we don't entertain them, we just kind of see them, and he says that's really useful information, like what you shared a few moments ago, Lynn, of how, you know, just noticing the stuff that goes through your mind but not condemning it, and just seeing how quickly the ego wants to condemn everything and to make everything into an enemy of the mind state, and just see that that's silly, and not judge, but choose the real alternative, which is the peace that says, I don't have to identify with that blather, and eventually that the interest in that blather goes away, and it, you know, disappears off the radar screen altogether. But I think that's kind of the last phase of things. I mean, it's been my perception anyway, is that you know, I can still be at peace and still watch the ego's 24/7, 365 blather and see how, you know, that's not going away until the, you know, as the Course puts it, God takes the final step. But as long as I don't make a big deal about what appears to be in the world, I'm helping to heal what I think of as the world, which is in my mind and nowhere else, by not condemning it. And there's really only one of me playing hooky from Perfect Oneness, and tag, I'm it. And we can all say the same thing, right?
Exactly. And so, yeah, as you do that, and it is a kind of step-by-step thing, and Jesus tells us that, you know, there are certain things you have to do. You have to believe this, first off. Mm-hmm. You have to believe this. And, you know, obviously we know that belief is, you know, really a lie too, and not the truth. But you have to start with something. And so, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, why doesn't God just do this for me? And, you know, I did for my whole life. I kept, you know, God, take this away. God, make this happen. God, do this for me. God, do that for me. I was just, you know, I thought God was my bitch. I was going to beg God until God gave me what I wanted or did what I thought should be done or fixed things the way I wanted them to be or whatever. You know, I thought that, you know, I could definitely make God's will be my will be God's will. And then I was highly disappointed when that didn't happen. But
you mean the saddle harness and whip didn't work? And
didn't work. but you know, people still put. You know, it amazes me that, you know, I did this, and sometimes I still do, I guess, or else I wouldn't be seeing it or thinking about it. Conditions on God and say, you know, God, if you love me, you would do this. God, if you're there, show yourself. God,
yeah, know? Those guilt trips on God really work well, don't they? Huh? How's that working out for you?
But you know, as I begin to realize that I'm the one who's doing it to myself, then, you know, I can say the same thing to me. Lynn, if you love me, let me go. Let me go.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I think that's why Jesus in his wonderful course says, you have to forgive me. Not that he needs forgiveness, but we need to forgive our decision-making mind's choice against that infinitely patient, infinitely kind, infinitely loving teaching, because we've made an enemy out of the one thing that can help us. And we have to forgive ourselves, and we do that by forgiving what appears to be everyone else outside of ourselves, including the little self that we think we are, the little Bruce and Lynn dream figure puppet characters that have their need machines and run around doing crazy, silly things in the world. And we have to forgive all that. We have to just, you know, eventually, you know, realize the folly of trying to make this dead horse work. And no matter how fancy a harness, bridle, and whip we, you know, attach to it, it's not going where we want it to go, as he goes, you know.
That's right. It
never has, never will. We get little teasers. I think that's why, you know, there's things in the world that seem to you know, go our way once in a while, just enough to you know, keep us, you know, we toss these dogs' bones once in a while, so that, you know, as egos. So that, you know, the propaganda still has some kind of, you know, hold on us. It has some kind of purchase power, you know. But eventually we realize, oh, you know, we just bought into a bunch of stuff that doesn't work. And that when we generalize that and see consistently how it has never satisfied us, that we, you know, kind of like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, you know, as Phil recognizes, you know, he has to try this over and over and over again until he finally says, hey, this just flat isn't working. Why would I continue to do this if it's not getting the results I want, which is the peace?
Yeah. And he recognized that the way to do that was through joining with his brothers in kindness, which he did. Look at, you know, how that personality changed from being that self-centered Bill, you know, jerk guy to becoming the, you know, the hero of the community. Mm-hmm. Everybody loved him. Everybody wanted to be around him. That's something I recognized last week. I was contemplating the other night, how I, you know, I just realized that people were afraid of me. And not, you know, not because I'm such a big bad person.
And not just on Halloween?
Not just on Halloween. People are afraid of me. People are afraid that I'm going to say something to them or that I'm going to, you know, somehow or the other. Because I'm a scary person, I guess. But not just me. Everybody is. Okay. Everybody is. And you know, people, I just noticed that someone was kind of being like, talking to me like they thought that what they were saying was going to upset me, and that they were so afraid that if I got upset, you know, I would reject them or, you know, whatever. I would, and I realized that's the truth. That's how Lynn is. Lynn will get upset with people if they say the wrong thing to her, and then Lynn will, you know, punish that person for, you know, doing that by, you know, rejecting them in some way or saying something rude or saying, or whatever, right? Whatever. You know, the passive aggressive stuff that Lynn does. And I'm not owning it. That's how I am not saying I. I'm saying Lynn does these things. That's the Lynn character characteristics. And I recognized that that was the case. And I thought, my God, you know, why would I want to be a scary person? Why would I want to make people afraid to talk to me? Why would I want people to be afraid to say the wrong thing that I might jump over them or whatever? And I just determined myself, I am going to become the person that brings peace into the room, not fear, that brings peace into the communication, not fear. And I just realized, you know, and I think, and I know, I don't think, I know it's in the course that, you know, how will you know a teacher of God? Because they're harmless. You will not be afraid of them. You, when they walk into the room, you will love them. Mm-hmm. Jesus says you'll be the kind of person that people will just automatically love. I want to be that person. You know, mm-hmm. whatever it takes, I want to be that person. And
I think there's a clarification. What we really are loves what everyone else really is. Eternally, always, ever, forever. However, the self that we believe ourselves to be, the little less self, I call it the SSS or seemingly separate self, aka ego, is terrified of what we really are. So I think that's why there's the anecdotal stories about, you know, people had to look away when they were in Jesus' presence because there was a peace that was so profound, they weren't ready for that. And those that weren't, you know, probably just weren't even in within earshot, you know, like the Monty Python Sermon on the Mount story, you know, blessed are the Greeks, right? But I think it's just, you know, it's an example of how, you know, we are attracted to what we, you know, the law of attraction, I think in a sense does work in the sense that there's one of two thought systems and in any given moment we're drawn to, things that confirm, what each of those two thought systems, profess. And we're either in the classroom of kindness and forgiveness and innocence that the Holy Spirit teaches because of our intrinsic oneness that's reflected in sameness here. Or we're in the ego's, you know, cutthroat, everyone in it for himself, dog eat dog, insanity kind of world where there's really, you know, nothing peaceful in that world. And everyone, we were watching, one of the latest, Star Wars movies the other day was about Solo, and I don't know if you've seen that one. Anyway, in that particular Star Wars movie, get my Star movie straight. There's one of Solo's in his earlier life, his colleagues, played by Woody Harrelson, you know, said, "Oh well, you can't trust anyone." And I was thinking, "Well, gosh, he's playing, you know, the archetype of the ego." I mean, in those moments, at least, you know, he was basically saying how, you know, the ego ranges from suspiciousness at best to viciousness at worst. And the ego is suspicious of everyone and everything because everything that seems to be outside is a threat. And that's why, you know, the ego condemns everything because it really, as I was reading in Ken's Journey Home book this morning, you know, everything that the ego does is an attempt to throw everyone else over the precipice, you know, because we think everyone is out to kill us, so we're going to beat him to the punch, and that's just the insanity of the ego. We don't see it that way in that extreme, but I think that's why A Course in Miracles is written in the way it is and has such stark contrasts, you know, often within the same paragraph and almost always within the same section where it basically, you know, lampoons the insanity of the ego, and then usually at least at the end of a section we'll give a saving grace reminder. It's like, and because you've invested so heavily in this insane thought system, if you can look at it and not judge yourself when you go into that, you'll gradually see the craziness of it and choose against it. And then the peace that's behind that will be self-evident and blaze forth. But you have to look at it. And that's why it's a course in not no rather than a course in yes. The yes is the infinitely beautiful, infinitely kind, infinitely loving, infinitely innocent, true capital S self that we all are and share. But we're completely oblivious of that until we forgive the crap we put in the way, as Robin Williams said about golfing, right? Yeah. Paraphrase there too. Yeah.
Yes. It's interesting, as you're saying that, you know, really what I'm hearing and thinking is that the ego, you know, is not deliberately trying to undermine us. The ego is trying to do its job, which is to keep us involved in the illusion. The whole purpose of the ego is to make the illusion seem viable, seem like it works, seem like you can't get out of it because it's the only way to see things. The whole purpose of the ego is to keep us entrenched in this thinking and in this judging, mm-hmm. in order to keep, otherwise the whole thing collapses.
Right, exactly.
You know, once we take our belief out of it, it's gone. Yeah. Like a house of cards, man.
Yep. If you stop condemning, because there's no reason to condemn, then, yeah, like you said, house of cards, it's just, it collapses in on itself. It implodes because there's nothing there. And interestingly enough, when you said collapsing, and reminded me of imploding, which even there's a colleague of mine in the realm of what's become known as sacred geometry, who actually he doesn't use that phrase, but the idea of some of the quantum physics, of the idea that the fundamental level matter really doesn't have, I mean, it's like infinitely dense. Because there's really no space that it occupies. And that was one of the conclusions this colleague of mine, Nassim Haramein, came to. And so it's really, and then along with others like Dan Winter, it's really like a controlled implosion, that keeps happening, but it's because there's nothing there. You know, what we think of as matter is really a hologram that has to be continuously recreated. We have to collapse the waveform over and over again. We have to keep breathing life into a silly, untenable, irresponsible, insane dream over and over and over again to keep it alive. But we do that so fast, you know, maybe 10 to the 44th times per second, perhaps, that we don't even see it. It's like it's a stroboscopic movie at an incredibly fast frame rate that we seamlessly in our minds piece together and call it reality, but it's just a pulsing, throbbing dream of nothingness. Anyway.
Exactly. You're making me, well, as you're saying those things, all I'm thinking are the images in Inception.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, great film.
As you're
film.
Saying
yeah.
that, I'm like, oh yeah, that's, yeah. I see that happening. Or yeah. like, you know, Doctor Strange, that same kind of, mm-hmm. you know, moving illusion that just is like perpetuating and shifting and changing. That's yeah. really what we're experiencing right
oh,
now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though it appears to be stable, and that's how our whole this whole thing is shifting all the time.
Yeah.
And that's why it's possible that we can shift from this reality that appears to be and you and I don't even share the reality. You and I, you know, we think we have a shared reality because we talk to each other, we study the same book, blah, blah, blah. We, you know, but absolutely what you see in the world and what I see in the world are completely different. I don't even know if you see the same colors I see, you know, mm-hmm. because we can't see another person's dream. We can't be involved. I can't be in your mind. So we assume that we're all having a shared reality, and so, you know, logically that would mean you would do this or do that or say this or say that. Logically, in a shared reality that is run by Lynn, that's managed by Lynn, the shit that's happening in the world right now wouldn't be happening. So, you know, I know.
Just ask the members of your family under your own roof, you know, what their priorities are for a given day or for, you know, their life in general, and you're going to get, well, maybe not wildly conflicting, you know, ideas, but the alignment is never possible within the dream, on both a local and a global level, because no matter how far you stretch, the idea of conflict, which is what the ego is, you're never going to find a harmony there because it's based on conflict. It's based on the belief in differences and separation. So.
Absolutely.
All right. Just give it up.
That's right. Just give it up.
You want to read the last two paragraphs?
I'll read the last two paragraphs. Okay. And now I'm going to reread. We've got enough time. I can reread that whole quote from the Course.
That's a good one.
And I'll just finish it all up. Sure. So because what I was going to say, Bruce, you know, you talk about the Course, it'll go through all the terrible things and all the awful stuff. And yes, there's always a solution. And the solution always includes your brother.
Yeah.
There's never a section that I read in the Course that says, you know, this is what you have to do, this is what you have to do without, or this is what's gone wrong, and this is how to fix it, that doesn't include joining with my brother.
Exactly.
And that's the whole, I mean, that's the problem, is that, you know, we refuse to join with our brother because we have these ideas about what our brother is. And what our brother's purpose is, and what our brother's viewpoint is, and what our brother's color is, and what our brother's height is, and what our brother's gender is. And, you know, we have all these ideas about all these things, and none of it is true. Mm-hmm. And if you drop those things and just look at the reality, you'll see that shiny baby face right in front of you. In fact, one of my groups were posting pictures of ourselves when we were babies or children, and it's just so sweet to look at those little faces. And you just want to just snuggle them and hug them and love them. Well, just you with that baby too, you know. We should love each other just that way. So I'm going to read this. Your relationship with your brother has been uprooted from the world of shadows, and its unholy purpose has been safely brought through the barriers of guilt, washed with forgiveness, and set shining and firmly rooted in the world of light. From there, it calls to you to follow the course it took, lifted high above the darkness and gently placed before the gates of heaven. The holy instant in which you and your brother were united is but the messenger of love sent from beyond forgiveness to remind you all of that, of all that lies beyond it. Yet it is through forgiveness that it will be remembered. And when the memory of God has come to you in the holy place of forgiveness, you will remember nothing else. And memory will be as useless as learning, for your only purpose will be creating. Yet this you cannot know until every perception has been cleansed and purified and finally removed forever. Forgiveness removes only the untrue, lifting the shadows from the world and carrying it safe and sure within its gentleness to the bright world of new and clean perception. There is your purpose now, and it is there that peace awaits you. And that's from A Course in Miracles. I'll find out where that's from in a minute. Then Artin and Persa disappeared, which they had a habit of doing, but I knew they were on the page. Always with me. It had been a lengthy talk, but I felt renewed by their wisdom and encouraged by their assurance. It would be possible for me to not have to wait for another lifetime in order to be enlightened. This was new and welcome information, but could I do it? I determined that the answer to that question was yes. I could see now that everything had happened for a reason. It all fit together. The Holy Spirit knew what he was doing, even if I didn't always know what I was doing. This was going to be my final stop, the one that ends in God. Amen.
Indeed, indeed. And while you're reading that, and thank you for that wonderful reading. I looked up in the bibliography in the back, or the reference in the back, that quote was from chapter 18, section 9. It's the second to the last paragraph in chapter 18 in The Two Worlds. So if anybody's wondering where that came from. I do have a quick announcement to make, and maybe you're aware of this, Lynn. I just found out about it in the last few weeks. And a week ago, I had a wonderful, lengthy conversation that lasted a better part of a couple hours, actually. Most of it recorded with Armin Rott, who is in Germany. And he and about 8 or 9 other people are putting together a global conference on A Course in Miracles. And this is different than MiracleShare, but this is a global conference, and it's called Awaken to Love. And it happens very soon, November 11th through the 25th this year, 2018. And if you go to acimblog.com, you will see an announcement on it right there. And you can register and participate. And I've already been recorded, so I will be one of the 100-plus people sharing in that conference. And it's kind of quite a large list of folks that are, most of whom will be familiar to you, I imagine. And anyway, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And as far as I know, the MiracleShare conference is still scheduled for January, but I know we've been working on that, and that is still kind of to be determined in terms of the exact details. But since all the MiracleShare websites are being revamped and everything, so I think we may still be on for January, but I'll have to double check on that. But meanwhile, the Awaken to Love virtual ACM conference is happening November 11th through 25th, which is less than a couple weeks away. So if you're the least bit interested, go to acimblog.com and check it out. So thank you.
We will do that. And Dove is saying with Armin Rott, and Yasuko is going to be there. Yasuko, I should say. Right, and Dove Fishman and John Monday, and maybe Suzanne DeKaiser.
Oh, great!
Some folks from this room actually.
There's a whole lot of folks you'll be familiar with when you go to the website. So yeah.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
Love it. You know, I would love to. Honestly, we had you at that conference here in Colorado, and I so enjoyed your talk.
Oh, thanks.
I would love to see you out there. Getting, you know, obviously you have a point of view that a lot of folks don't have. I mean, you have the scientific stuff going for you that a lot of other folks don't. I'm surprised you're not at the SAND conference, since that seems to be the big deal for anybody who's into science. But
you know, I thought about that, and that'd be fun to do. So yeah, thanks for that suggestion. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, very good. All right. Well, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
Likewise.
It's been wonderful. And we have one more chapter in this book. Maybe we'll get it done before the end of the year.
I think we might.
Well, so Cindy is asking when the SAND conference is. It's actually right now. I think I saw Chuck Hillig is there and a lot of other folks.
Okay.
So Science and Non-Duality Conference this year is happening now, or just happened.
Okay.
Anyway. Thanks again, Bruce, and I'm going to let go of the mic and turn it over to you, Iris and Carrie. The mic is all yours.